Okay, well, welcome everyone. Thank you so much for coming. It's really good to see so many people coming along. So myself and Steve have created this workshop together. We're going to be looking at being better at stress and managing worry as well. So we'll start with Steve will talk us through a little bit around what is stress and some ways that we can be better at stress, really. And then I'll take over a little bit with some more long-term strategies for managing stress and managing worry as well. In case of you, those of you who don't know me, my name is Sian Hawkins. I'm a psychological wellbeing practitioner, and I work for the NHS in a primary care mental health service. So my work mainly involves working with people with common mental health difficulties like common anxiety disorders or depression. So mainly focusing on cognitive behavioural therapy techniques, which I'll be drawing on a little bit today. But I'll hand over to Steve just to get us started.
Okay, I'll introduce myself. For those that don't know me, I'm Steve. I actually work as a school counsellor, seeing young people with emotional health issues, and I use CBT amongst a variety of techniques. I'm going to be drawing on the stuff that I've found useful working with young people, and there's no reason why they shouldn't work with older people as well, so that's fine. So the first thing is, what is stress? So I wonder whether, just to kick off, you can see the words that I've got up there and I'm not going to start repeating them, but what do you feel is being stressed, and how do you know that you're stressed? Anyone?
I get cross.
Yeah? Yeah. Your emotions start becoming difficult to manage. Yeah. And it comes over the top. Any other things that you notice when you're stressed?
Well, you've got the physical side of things where your heart is racing.
Yep, heart races. Anything else? Any other physical signs that you notice in your body?
Your body is paining.
Your body?
Pains?
Yeah. Could be, yep.
You sweat more profusely.
Sweat more profusely, good one. Any others?
Can't concentrate on anything.
You can't concentrate on anything, good one. We were talking a little bit about that. Any others?
Less deeply, don't you? I breathe more shallow.
Breathing more shallow, often faster, yeah, goes alongside the increase in heart rate, absolutely. Anything else? Yep, Carl.
I get really down and upset when I'm stressed.
Yep, yeah. Our emotions can be all over the place, and we'll talk a little bit about...
Can be.
Right. Another thing is often you feel butterflies in your tummy. You feel things in your tummy. So those are all signs that we're stressed. Now, we don't like those signs. They are unpleasant, and we generally, the first thoughts are to get away from them, to back off, not to do it. And one of the things I'm going to be talking about is what actually happens and how we can use stress to perform better. And that's why the title here is Being Better at Stress. We don't try and get away from it. We want to be better. Here's a number of the things, and I think a lot of what's up there was mentioned. Blood pressure rises. That's all part of what we call the fight or flight reaction, which is a primitive reaction, and by that I mean one that starts... we share with all other animals. Interestingly, it's not strictly just fight, flight. It's actually fight, flight, freeze, and faint are actually the four reactions to stress. If you notice a wild animal that's been startled by a hunter being hunted and it suddenly sees it, it will freeze first, working out what to do, and then it will go. And actually, in extreme, it will faint. And the reason it faints is because, generally speaking, hunters don't touch dead meat. They don't touch dead animals. So if you faint and play dead, actually, you get away with it. And we've still got that reaction. In extreme stress, you can faint. It is one of the reactions that can happen. Indigestion, tremor, jelly legs, etc. They're all there. Just to mention, I've got the microphone on. You won't hear anything out of the speakers, but it is available on the loop, and we're also recording it. This is like the fire alarm going off. It's saying there is some big problem that we've got to address. It's an issue, it's a problem, we've got to address it. And that's really useful when we are in danger. And the fight-flight mechanism comes from the time when danger meant life or death. Now, we perceive it as danger, but actually, we're not in a life or death situation. But it's still useful. One of the problems that's been noted, and there was a lot of work done in the early 50s using predominantly mice, that established the link between the constant release of stress hormones and all sorts of physical health problems. And that is well established, it is well known. Constant stress will cause a number of different problems. But you don't ever kind of, no doctor's going to write on a death certificate stress as such, but some of these things can lead to bad health and ultimately death. So we've got to find a way. What's going on here? The press have really played it all up, and they play on our minds. Stress is really bad for you. You can see up there the sneaky enemy, the end of stress. Stress is bad, and it feels bad, so actually we want to back off from it. We want to get away from it. And I can remember back when I first started as an engineer, and I was a manager of a team, and I had a guy come into me. I didn't know him before, and he'd been off long-term sick and had just come back. And the reason he was off on long-term sick was because he'd had his wife died, he'd had to sort out his kids, he'd moved, he had done all these sort of things, and so he was off work for stress. And he said to me, a stress counsellor came to visit him and see him. And in those days, what they did was they said, wife died, this is this amount of points, this is this amount of points. And then they said, if you're more than like 30, you're badly stressed. And he told me he scored about 90. And the person pretty much said, well, you should be dead by now. So he turned around to him and said, well, what do I do about it? Well, try and get rid of some of the stress in your life. And he's saying, well, how do I change the fact that my wife's died? How do I change the fact that I've moved? It just didn't make sense at that time. It didn't all link together. What I'm going to talk about now is being better in stressful situations when you're facing a challenge. And in just a minute, Sian's going to come and talk about how you deal with the longer term worry. But I want you to go out of here feeling that if you're facing a stressful situation, a challenge, that actually you can use stress to make you perform better, and go through how that works. Recent findings in the late 80s, early 90s, people started to cotton on to the fact that we weren't getting this stress thing right. Simply saying stress is bad for you doesn't work. So they actually set up in America, they did a survey of, I think it was 90 or 100,000 people, where they surveyed what their stressful life was actually like. And they got ideas about what they thought about stress, what their life was like, what stress they were under, all in a questionnaire. And then they went back, after about 7 or 8 years, went through the public death records and worked out who had died. Pretty morbid, yeah, but that's what they actually did. And some of the results were quite interesting. What they found was that if you were experiencing high levels of stress, you were 43% more likely to die than someone than the norm. But when they scratched a bit further and looked a bit further, what they found was it depended on your attitude to stress. People who were stressed and said stress is not a problem had a normal, if you like, life expectancy. So they actually did an extrapolation of those results, and they looked at what would happen nationally if everyone believed that stress was bad for them, and they found it came as the number 15 on the causes of death in America. And it's purely the attitude towards stress that they were looking at. The second thing that they noted was that what did you even better than that was people who looked after other people and were stressed did even better. They didn't necessarily totally understand it, but those were the results. I've just jumped on and said stressed people who care for others live longer. Let me explain what's going on here. I want to introduce oxytocin. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of it, but it's nicknamed the cuddle hormone. It has been suggested that we should snort it in order to make us do better with everybody. It tends to make you want to be sociable with people who are important to you. And when you are sociable with people who are important to you, you release more of the stuff. It's also a stress hormone, and it is released when you are stressed, and it primes you to go and seek support from people around you. The interesting thing about oxytocin is it also has been found to bind with blood vessels and the heart and prime them to repair the damage that stress causes. So actually, by being sociable with others, you are making yourself more resilient to stress. In the early 2000s, we started the International Happiness Index, where they went round to all sorts of countries and said, who's the happiest country? And you've probably heard occasionally it's quipped that Scandinavia, Finland, etc. are the happiest people around. And that was all well and good. But since then, sociologists have been digging into the data, and what they found is that high stress does not correlate with low happiness. In fact, many of the countries that are highly stressed have the happiest index. Interesting as to quite what's going on there. Actually, what we find, and I'll bring it up later, is that the stressful times in life are the happiest times. And being stressed brings reward. If you think back over your life, you will find that the most rewarding times of your life are very often the times when you were under most stress. Because you'll also have had laughter, fun, in amongst all of the stress. So actually, avoiding stress means that you don't lead such a fulfilling life as you do when you are stressed, in many cases. Some more recent papers are showing that because being stressed stimulates the immune system, people who are moderately stressed, not saying highly stressed, actually recover quicker from surgery. And because of this stimulation of the immune system, and also the fact that when you are stressed, I'll talk about it more in a minute, your brain works faster and we use the brain more. It actually has been shown, we think, very recent research is suggesting it helps with diseases such as Alzheimer's. So in other words, avoiding stress when you're older isn't such a good idea. So what if we embrace stress? We rethink your stress response as being helpful. That pumping heart is pushing blood around your body, is taking oxygen, is taking energy around your body. It's also making you feel more clear-headed, alert, with sharper senses, and better able to meet the challenge. What I say to the young people that I meet is replace the word anxious with energized. It's actually your body energizing you. One of the things you might say to me is, but hang on a minute, those are all making my muscles work faster and better. Think of your brain as a muscle. Its needs to think are exactly the same as your muscle, as your muscles. It needs oxygen, it needs energy, and it needs the blood to take it all around. Exactly what is happening here. There's a significant improvement in performance. I mentioned a study that kind of showed this in America, where what they did was they had a group of, it was undergraduate students going to take their exams, and they were actually going to take their business exams, and part of it was they had to give a presentation on business. So what they said to them was, look, we'd like you to do, we're doing a study, so they wired them up for sound to check how stressed they were, and they had them stand up in front of a panel of experts who were going to criticize and give them feedback on their presentation. What they didn't know was those experts had been trained to make the thing as stressful as possible. They'd interrupt them, they'd say, hang on a minute, go back to the beginning, this is all wrong, anything to stress them out. Before they went to see it, they divided the group into two. One group, they said, they went to them and they showed them a video that said, you've heard about stress being bad, actually it's not so bad. All of the stuff that I've just been saying about stress. And the other lot, they said, you think stress is bad? It's far worse. It kills you, it does this, it does that. And what they found was that the people who had seen the video saying it's okay did noticeably better in that stressful test than the other people. Notably as well, the stress indicators on their bodies were the same. They all felt the same stress. So it doesn't take away those feelings of being stressed. One thing I want to just explain is a little bit about what's going on in your body. And I want to introduce the limbic system. And the limbic system is the oldest part of the brain. It's the part of the brain that we share with everybody else. And the way best to show it is to use my hand as a model. If you consider that my arm is the spinal column and my base of palm is the base of the brain and this is the back part of the brain, if I fold my thumb over, my thumb is what I would call the limbic system. It's a number of different structures. It is concerned with memory, it's concerned with generating hormones into your body and signalling. It's the fast part of your brain that controls the memory. It's as connected to all your senses as everything else is, and it's the part of the brain that triggers the fight-flight response. It works really fast. It's what gives you your instant reactions. When you learn to catch a ball, you were teaching your limbic brain to catch the ball, so you do it automatically. It works without you thinking. You're not conscious of what's going on. It works at the subconscious level. And over the top, you have the cortex, the thinking brain that we have that's different from any other animals. Now, when the limbic brain detects that there is danger, it starts preparing the body for exercise. A good way to describe this is if I take everybody back about 2 million years and you think that we're walking through the savannah in Africa and we're thinking about what we're going to have for lunch and wasn't it good at the campfire last night. I'm not sure we have language quite yet, but we're going on and considering those things. Do we go ford a river and get some berries, or do we get some grain, or should we chase after a gazelle? Our limbic brain, which is connected to all our senses, suddenly detects some shadows in the grass that it thinks might be a saber-toothed tiger. Alarm bells go off. We're still thinking in our nice new cortex and we're thinking all these things, but alarm bells have gone off. And what it then starts to do is pump out hormones to get us ready to run. Exactly what I just said up there. It gets the blood circulating, putting out the adrenaline, puts out another one called cortisol, which releases energy into the bloodstream, and it's getting the body ready. So the body's all ready, but the cortex doesn't know anything about it. We're still thinking about what lunch can we have. What it also does is it releases neurohormones that actually affect the way you think when you're stressed. The first thing it needs to do is wake you up, snap you out of it. And what it does is the neurohormones actually wake up, make you more alert. They take away that feeling of drowsiness, and you start running in hyperdrive because it needs you to think fast. The second thing it does is it makes you more aware of your senses because it needs you to focus on what it spotted and decide what it is. Is it actually a saber-toothed tiger, or is it actually just shadows in the grass and it's okay and we can carry on and do things? But if it is a saber-toothed tiger, we've got to work out what do we do about it. And we've got to work out what we do about it really, really quickly. So it primes us to go with the first thing we think of. And one of the problems can be is if you're primed to suddenly your senses are made in hyperdrive, they're really sensitive, like it's like the gain's turned up, then you can notice that your body's behaving weirdly. You hadn't spotted it before. My heart's going faster. I've got butterflies in my tummy. And you think to yourself, oh, my body's going out of control. You think my body's going out of control, so your limbic system says, woohoo, this is worse than I thought. So it pumps more of the hormones out, your heart beats faster, and all of a sudden, that is a cause for you getting a panic attack. So we've got to work within this, and when you are facing a challenge, you've got to realise that those neurohormones are affecting the way you think. So what should we do about facing immediate challenges? The thing we've got to do with our cortex is be very clear on what we're going to actually do. What's our plan to meet the challenge? And focus on that and nothing else. Because what we want is our limbic system to actually go execute it. Our limbic system's almost like a little child, a little jockey that's in charge of our body. And we've got to be alongside it and tell it what it's got to do. Because otherwise, it's going to get the heck out and zoom off. And probably make a poor decision. Whereas what we want is, for example, for me to come up here and stand in front of you and talk to you, as opposed to go and hide in the corner, which my limbic system would love to do. How do we do that? The first thing we've got to do is have a plan. So if you're caught unawares, one of the first things is you can pause and formulate a plan as to how you're going to meet the challenge. Or, if you've got time to prepare, you formulate a challenge beforehand. And then you rehearse if you can. You know, soldiers going into battle, paramedics going into difficult situations, policemen going in, the way they prepare to go into those difficult situations, they don't know what they're going to face, is they have a plan that they rehearse. They have a procedure they're going to go through. They will always do the same thing. You've got to do the same thing for anything that you're going to do. So you take control. You tell that little jockey, the limbic system, what you want it to do. And focus on that, not on the sensations you're getting in your body. We will all get them. You will always get them. No one can take them away. They're part of being human. But you don't focus on them. You focus on the plan. I'm going to show you a video now quickly before Sian will just put it on. And I'll just explain this. What I need you to do is to focus on the first 10 or 15 seconds of the video, It's not very long. That's why I'm going to explain it now. What you're going to see is Jenny Jones, who is the only Brit to get an Olympic gold on snow, talking to a lady called Anna Gasser. Now, Jenny knows Anna quite well because when Jenny was at the top of her game, Anna Gasser was just starting out. Anna Gasser is probably the leading snowboarder in the world, certainly over the last season. And they'll talk about a triple. And the triple they're talking about is a triple somersault where actually the head has to go under the board three times. Absolutely crazy. Now, only at the time that this video was made, only two men had ever done a triple. And no woman anywhere, including Anna Gasser, had ever attempted a triple before. What you will notice is Anna... Take particular note of how she looks and what she's doing. You know, she's pretty nervous. Just have a look and see. The bit that's missed out, unfortunately, in this clip from the original broadcast version is that Anna went over off to one side before she actually went down the slope, and you saw her doing this. What do you think she was doing? She was rehearsing it. She was visualising what she was going to do, even though she'd never done it before, as had no other woman. She knew what she wanted to do, but she'd never done it before. And the rest of it's good fun, and I'll leave it running, because it's good fun to watch. Okay, Sean.
Okay.
You're focusing on a...
Are you? Can you help? I'll turn the sound up.
Root for real. Right now. Shall I move completely out of your way, then? Yes. Anna's thinking about doing a triple. Just see what happens. Triple, triple. One, two,
oh my God.
Three. Oh my God, Anna Gasser just landed a triple right there! Excited face!
Oh my
God, did we ever! First time!
First try on snow.
Any hands down?
No.
No, you're such a boss, Anna.
So that's what you can do when you amplify or get as much of the anxiety and stress hormone going in your body to get everything on fire, and away you go.
Far and away.
I just need to stop that.
Sorry.
Over to Sean.
Oh, do you have the clicker?
Right by your foot.
There. Thank you. So as Steve was talking about facing those immediate challenges and kind of coping with that immediate stress that we feel. And I'll talk a little bit more about managing more the long-term effects of stress. Because as Steve pointed out earlier, stress can be really helpful in the short term. It's going to help us to prepare and do what we need to do. But in the long term, it's not a state we want to be in constantly. So when we're looking at managing stress, there's broadly two ways we can do that. We can try to manage the external pressures. So trying to manage the source of the stress, really. So and this is going to be different for everyone, but it might be things like financial stress, it might be work, education, anything like that. But one way we can do that is identify what the sources are and, if possible, problem solve or make some changes there. But that's not always possible, unfortunately, especially if maybe a big source of our stress is other people. We can't change other people, we can't control what they say, what they do. So in that case, all we can do really is try to manage and develop our emotional resilience so that we feel better able to cope with those situations. And so think a bit like these weighing scales. So quite often when we're feeling stressed, the demands that are being placed on us are outweighing our resources. So when we talk about resources, that could be quite practical material things like having the money or having the support to deal with those problems. But it can also mean our emotional resilience, so how we feel internally able to cope with these things. So there's a few different ways that we can do that, and I'll talk through a couple of the main ways that we can try to manage that more long-term stress. And one of them is by trying to make sure we have quite a good balance of activities in our lives. And so rather than doing all the things we have to do or need to do, making sure we've got a good balance of other things in there as well. And there's been some research done, and they found that these particular activities are really helpful for managing or maintaining good, well, optimal brain matter, but also for managing our well-being. And they call it the healthy mind platter, which you might have seen before. So in the same way that we need to have a balanced diet to maintain our body, we need to have a balance of different activities to maintain our well-being. So they recommend having a daily dose of each of these things, even if it is just a small amount, can go a long way to helping manage that stress. So the first one, sleep time, probably all know how important sleep is for both body and mind, but both the quantity and the quality of that sleep. And there's a lot of information out there about tips for better sleep called sleep hygiene, which might be helpful to have a look at. But also putting in some physical time, so ideally some aerobic exercise, but that's not always possible. So even if it is lighter exercise, like going for a walk, gardening, housework, anything like that, having some real focus time. So this is where we're focusing on just one task at a time, which I think is increasingly difficult these days, actually. So we might have something on the TV, looking at our phone, looking at the iPad. So just having time focusing on one particular thing. And having time in is more when we're kind of internally focusing. So actually tuning into how we're feeling, what we're thinking, both in body and emotionally how we're feeling. So just having that time to tune in a little bit. And downtime is what it says on the tin. So just having time to relax and unwind. Playtime, so doing something just because it's fun, and connecting as well. So spending that time, quality time with other people. And there's increasingly more emphasis on this connecting time. And GPs have actually started doing what they call social prescribing. So if you go to your GP saying, I'm struggling at the moment, they might not prescribe medication. They might actually prescribe classes or some sort of activity where you're going to be connecting with other people. And there was an article recently on the BBC of a GP in either Cornwall or Devon who started to prescribe surfing lessons as a way of getting this connection. And actually hits quite a few of those things, the physical, the focus, the playtime as well. So it might be something you see coming up even more. So it's all very well saying get a balance, but it can be quite difficult to do this, especially if we don't have the time necessarily. But quite often a barrier to this is people feel a little bit uncomfortable maybe with focusing on themselves and their self-care, especially if we're quite used to looking after other people and putting them first. But it's important that we do focus on self-care as well, because think of it a little bit like an oxygen mask when we think of our self-care. So if you've ever flown anywhere, you give the usual health and safety spiel at the beginning, and they always say, in case of an emergency, if an oxygen mask comes down, you need to make sure you put your own mask on before you try to help anyone else. And it's the same thing with our self-care, actually, because if we're not looking after ourselves, ultimately, you know, we're going to get to the point where we burn out and we're not going to be much help to anyone really, and including work as well. We're not going to be at our productive best if we're not looking after ourselves. So it can feel difficult, and often people feel that it's almost selfish to do that, but actually we need to think of it as being just as important as anything else we do really. And it can be helpful when we're looking at trying to get a balance to think about your values. So actually, what matters to you most in life? And more importantly, are you living in line with those values? So are you doing the things that matter most? If you really value family or your friendships, are you spending that time with those people? If you really value your physical well-being, are you exercising? So sometimes we can find when we're struggling with our well-being, there's this mismatch between the stuff that's the most important to us and whether and how we're living, if we're actually doing those things. So it could be a case of just experimenting, really, with just planning in a bit of time, even if it's just those small doses of those different things, and just seeing if that does help to make a difference. And I've worked with clients before who, when they're feeling particularly stressed, they complete a baseline diary. So it's kind of recording their activity throughout a week and getting them to think about and measure actually how much they had a sense of enjoyment, a sense of achievement, or closeness to other people. And sometimes it's a huge eye-opener, actually, when they come back and they reflect and can't see a single thing actually that they've enjoyed or found relaxing. So it's worth, if we can, trying to fit that time in. So that's, I guess, more practical things we can change and what we do. But there's also a big part of stress when it comes to how we think. So when we're feeling stressed, we might have more unhelpful thoughts, and that might make us feel even more stressed. And quite a common theme when it comes to stress is this kind of critical self-talk. So this can look different for everyone, but it might often be putting ourselves down. So we can be quite harsh on ourselves, thinking I'm useless, never get anything right. We can take on more responsibility than we need to for things and blame ourselves when we don't need to. We can put a lot of pressure on ourselves and have quite high expectations, thinking I should do this, I must do that, I ought to do that. And just overall think that we can't cope with the demands being placed on us. And it can be really helpful just to start recognizing how we're thinking, especially those times when we're feeling stressed, and thinking, actually, what is it I'm telling myself during these moments? Because it's quite easy sometimes to just accept our thoughts as being true, but they're not necessarily, they're not always facts. The way we think is shaped by so many different things, by our experiences, what's happened to us before, how other people have treated us. So over time, our thinking can become a little bit biased and generally more unhelpful. So a good place to start is just starting to question these thoughts actually when they do come up. And I guess the reason why I suggest this is because it can have such a big impact on how we feel and how much we feel we can cope with the demands placed on us. And quite a helpful way, I think, of thinking about this is with Coach A and Coach B. So we've got little Johnny, there he is in the corner, who scores an own goal at his football match, which is just the worst, isn't it? But so with the situation, we have Coach A, who berates Johnny in front of everyone, tells him he's useless, he's cost them the game, it's all his fault. We have Coach B, takes him to one side later on, reassures him that actually everyone makes mistakes. They have a think about what happened, what was the error, and puts in some time to help him practice at the end. So it's probably quite obvious to us maybe which is the more helpful approach. It's probably going to be Coach B. But the question really is actually, which coach do you tend to be to yourself? So in these stressful situations, are you showing yourself any compassion or any kindness, or actually are you adding that pressure even more? So just helpful to bear in mind, really, because the trouble with our thoughts is there's no one else there to back us up or stand up for us when we have these thoughts. Whereas if someone was just stood there telling us you're useless, you're no good, you'd hope that someone would stick up for us and say, hang on, that's not true, that's not really fair. But there's no one to do that for us when it's just how we're thinking. So we need to kind of be able to do that and challenge that thought ourselves. And I guess one helpful technique we find just to start challenging these thoughts is something called the stop technique. So if we notice ourselves feeling stressed or starting to notice these unhelpful thoughts, just remembering stop. So it's just stop, take a breath, get a bit of an overview. What is it I'm telling myself right now? What's making me feel like this? And then getting in some perspective. So actually, what's the bigger picture? How important is this really? Is it going to matter in 5 years' time or even a month's time? And what advice would I give to a friend? I think is usually quite a helpful one, because actually, if a friend came to us and they'd made a mistake, like little Johnny, we're unlikely to say all those awful things to them, or at least I hope we wouldn't. But it's so much easier sometimes to show other people compassion that we wouldn't necessarily show ourselves. So that's quite a helpful one, trying to talk to ourselves the way we would a friend in that situation. And just reminding ourselves, actually, is this thought true? Because they're not always necessarily. So it's kind of a whistle-stop tour of challenging thoughts a little bit, or starting that process. Any questions or comments, or anyone else notice this, actually, these kind of unhelpful thoughts coming up? Yeah, go on.
Sometimes I can get down on stress for no particular reason whatsoever.
Okay.
Is that an obvious?
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes it's not really obvious if there's a trigger.
Sometimes I just cry for no particular reason whatsoever.
Yeah.
Is that normal as well?
Yeah, and I think, yeah, sometimes it's not really obvious to us maybe why we're feeling upset or why we're feeling stressed. So I guess this is kind of looking at sometimes the way we think might affect how we feel, but it's not always that obvious, no. Yeah, okay. Any other questions or comments at all?
Do you find this is a gradual process?
Yeah.
To change those thought habits?
Yeah, absolutely. And as I mentioned, the way we think is shaped over quite a long time. So it can take a bit of time and practice, really, with challenging these thoughts. But it definitely can be done with just starting to shift our thinking, not necessarily becoming suddenly really positive about everything, but at least just shifting it away from the negative to something that's a bit more neutral, really, and a bit more balanced. Yeah. Okay. So we looked a bit at how we can change what we do and changing how we think. But when it comes to managing stress, we can also approach it physically, so with some structured relaxation. And some of you might already be familiar with these. But the idea is we can kind of turn the dial down a little bit on that stress response, so bring our heart rate down, bring our breathing rate down, and help to relax our muscles. And one of the most recommended ones is something called controlled breathing, and there's lots of different variations of this, but one of the most recommended one is called square breathing, which is kind of summed up in this, really. So sometimes it helps to have a bit of a visual cue to follow. So we'd be starting up here and just breathing in, preferably through the nose, for about 4 seconds, and then holding the breath for 4 seconds, breathing out for 4 seconds, and then holding again for 4 seconds, and just repeating round that way. And the reason why we recommend this is because if we can control our breathing, if we can regulate it, slow it right down, it's going to force a lot of those stress symptoms to come down, because they'd be at odds at each other, actually, if we're breathing quite calmly, regularly, to have everything else kind of going haywire. So we recommend doing that and practicing each day, even if it's just a few minutes. And the good thing about controlled breathing is it's free and we can take it with us wherever we go. So it's well worth having that in our kind of toolkit. Another one we recommend is something called progressive muscle relaxation. So this is basically working through the major muscle groups in our body and first of all tensing them, usually for about 5 seconds, and then releasing for 10 seconds before moving on to the next muscle. So for example, if we started with our hands, it would be kind of clenching our fists for 5 seconds and then releasing for 10 seconds and then moving on to the arm and tensing there. So just working through the major muscle groups. And the reason for this is you might notice sometimes when you're stressed, our muscles do tense. Again, a big part of that stress response. And sometimes we might not even recognize it. So this technique, if we practice it, means that we're a little bit better able to recognize actually that tension. We get used to noticing our muscles being tense, and it's that little bit easier to then relax that tension. So again, it's well worth practicing, even if it's just a couple of minutes each day, just so that we're better able to do that when we really need it as well. And there's also the app Headspace, which people might have already used or come across. So this has some really helpful guided meditation on there, and with some really nice visual animations to follow as well. So this is kind of NHS recommended, can be really helpful. Any questions about that, or has anyone used any kind of, yeah, go on.
So Headspace, and it's absolutely excellent.
Yeah.
I think I did have to pay for it actually.
Yeah.
To go beyond 10 days, but it's not a lot of money. It's really, really good.
No, yeah.
Lots of different things. It's not just asleep.
No, that's it. And I think you're right. I think you have kind of a trial, free trial, and then it's a kind of monthly subscription. But yeah, and it's well worth bearing in mind if you struggle with sleeping, because it does have these kind of sleep casts. So it's kind of peaceful stories that you can listen to. So it gives you something else to focus on, particularly if you find yourself worrying a lot when you're trying to sleep. So it's just something else to occupy your mind, which is quite calming and relaxing. So no, it sounds like a good experience with that. Yeah, thank you. Sorry, Carl, what were you saying?
I was going to say, you know, you talked about an app.
Yes.
Where can I find it and what's it called?
Okay, for this app, the Headspace app, was it?
Yes. So, or anything that will help me out of stress when I'm trying to sleep.
Yeah, so Headspace would probably be quite a good one for that. There's also a couple other ones I could write down for you as well at the end. One is called Calm, which plays some quite ambient noises, so things like rainfall, things like that, which can, again, helpful to fall asleep to. So there's a few different ones, and they're either on, I think, the iStore, or I think they're available on all kind of smartphones as well. Okay, I can write some down for you at the end as well. Okay. Okay, great. Anyone else have any experience with the kind of structured relaxation at all? Okay, so I already spent some time looking at stress and wanted to spend some time thinking a bit more about worry as well, because the two quite often come hand in hand. And we're probably all familiar with what a worry is. I'm sure we're all worried at times. So when we think about worries, they're normally negative thoughts that make us feel anxious, basically. And we can quite often worry about things that haven't necessarily happened yet, so worrying about things in the future. That's probably the most common. And we can also worry about the past. So this might look like kind of dwelling or ruminating on things and thinking, oh, what if I'd done this differently, or if only I'd done that in a different way. And can worry about things right now. So if it's happening here and now, my car's just broken down. So with worrying, it's a normal process. It's something we all do from time to time. But it can sometimes get to the point where it feels excessive. Maybe it feels a bit overwhelming. And it can start to impact quite a lot on day-to-day life. So just wondering, just I guess a quick shout out. What do you think are some of the most common things people tend to worry about?
The main thing I worry about, and I'm doing a lot of it at the moment, is changes.
Changes, yeah. So, and quite, I think uncertainty as well, quite a lot of the time, can be really hard.
The way my house is at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, so changes is a huge one, actually. Yeah. Anything else you think we tend to worry about?
Unsafe behaviour.
Unsafe behaviour, yeah. Yeah, no, that is a big worry, definitely. Anything else at all?
Money.
Money, yeah.
Obligation.
Yeah.
The tyranny of enough, are you doing enough?
Yeah.
Are you good enough around the
platform? Yeah, you know, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think you probably hit a lot of the big ones there, especially stuff like finances, family, I guess pretty much every part of life, really, we could probably worry about. And I've got quite a helpful video actually from the app Headspace, which I think is usually a good place to start when we're looking at managing worries. So if you wouldn't mind, Steve, thank you.
They're it's often good. Quite different to how people imagine it to be. Maybe they have an idea it's about stopping thoughts or eliminating feelings, but the reality is a bit different. An easy way to think of it is to imagine yourself sitting on the side of a busy road, the passing cars representing the thoughts and the feelings. All you have to do is to sit there and watch the cars. Sounds easy, right? But what usually happens is that we feel a bit unsettled by the movement of the traffic. So we run out into the road and try and stop the cars, or maybe even chase after a few, forgetting that the idea was to just sit here. And of course, all of this running around only adds to the feeling of restlessness in the mind. So training the mind is about changing our relationship with the passing thoughts and feelings, learning how to view them with a little more perspective. And when we do this, we naturally find a place of calm. Will we sometimes forget the idea of the exercise and become distracted? Of course we will. But as soon as we remember, here we are, back on the side of the road again, just watching the traffic go by, perfectly at ease in both body and mind.
So I like that one, just because it gets us thinking about the relationship we have with our thoughts, actually, and especially with worry, because we actually think of worry as being a behaviour. It's something we do. It takes up our time and our energy. So we can quite often think of worry as just being the thoughts, but actually it's something we're engaging in. We're kind of tending to those worries. We're responding to them. So quite often people can have, whether we realise it or not, we can have certain beliefs about worry and how it might be helpful in some way. But we quite often find with the worrying itself, that process of thinking and dwelling and ruminating, that itself isn't helpful. What is helpful to us is if we can take action or if we can problem solve. So just to give you a couple of examples of what I mean by these beliefs we can have about worrying. A really, really common one is believing that worrying shows I'm a caring person. So if I worry about my family, it must mean, you know, I love them and I care about them. We might believe that worrying helps us to be better prepared for things. Well, if I didn't worry, I, you know, wouldn't get things done. Worrying motivates us, and worrying protects us from negative emotions. Again, this is quite a big one sometimes, where people think that if we worry about that worst case scenario, if it does ever happen, maybe we'll feel a bit better prepared to deal with it, or it won't come as such a big shock or affect me as much. So that's another really common one to come up. And we might not necessarily be aware of these beliefs. They might not be that obvious to us. But it's quite important, if they are there, that we do recognize that, because it's going to be more difficult to manage worry and change our approach to it if on some level we feel like it's helpful to us. So again, as I said, it's not the process of worrying itself that's helpful. It's if we can take any action. And even if we can't do anything about it, still that worrying isn't helpful. It's not actually changing anything. So just to be able to challenge the idea that worrying is helpful, we can ask ourselves a couple of questions. So we could ask ourselves, well, do I know caring people who don't worry as much as I do? And actually, are there other ways that I can show I can care? We can give people our time, we could give them gifts. There's lots of different ways that we can do that apart from worrying. And if you think about it, if someone in your family or a friend came up to you and said, oh, I've been worrying about you so much all this last week, I've just been thinking about you, how are you going to cope, what are you going to do? How would we respond? It would be like, lovely, thank you. I'm really glad you've been worrying about me all week. Probably not. We'd probably wish they'd done something a bit nicer with their time than worrying about us. So just something that might help to challenge that a little bit more. Are we confusing worrying with actually doing something? So again, coming back to this idea that it's not the worry itself that's helpful, it's what we then do with it, if anything? And am I really more motivated when I worry? Because actually, quite often, if we're really worried about something, probably end up feeling anxious. We might feel quite overwhelmed. And for a lot of people, they just end up putting things off altogether, which is kind of the opposite of motivation. And that last one, so if we think about it, if something bad did really happen, would we feel any better for it, actually, if we'd worried about it? Would it upset us any less than if we hadn't worried about it? So just a couple of questions, and might be helpful just to reflect if you recognise any of those beliefs and just starting to challenge those a little bit more. But when we kind of come on to starting to manage worry, one of the first steps is recognising what sort of worry we have. So generally speaking, they can be one of the two categories. So we can have quite practical worries, which are more based on current situations. So it's the here and now happening to us, and we can do something about it. So for example, I have a toothache, so that's a current problem, and I have options. I could book a dentist appointment, take painkillers, could try to remove it myself. So some ideas are better than others, but there are options. The other kind of worry are more hypothetical. So these are normally about the future. We don't know for sure if they're going to happen, and we can't really control whether they're going to happen either. So for example, what if my car breaks down? You could argue we could do some practical things. We could have our car serviced regularly and do certain things to prevent it from happening. But ultimately, we don't know if our car's going to break down, if or when, and can't control that really. So that's the main difference between those two types of worry. And sometimes they're a bit of a mix of both. It's not always that clear cut. But quite a helpful tool to help us recognise that is something called the worry tree. So it just guides us on what type of worry you might be having and what we can then do with it. So if you start right at the top of the tree, the first step is obviously noticing the worry and really pinning down actually what specifically is it I'm worried about. And then the crucial question really is asking, can I do something about this? So if the answer is yes, so on the right-hand side of the tree, then we can put a bit of an action plan in place. We can think about what we need to do, when, how we're going to do it, and whether we can do it right now or if we can't. So if we can do it now, great, we can put it into action and we can let the worry go at that point because we've dealt with it. But even if we can't do it now, we can still let it go because actually we've got a plan, we can schedule when we're going to do it and let go of it at that point. The other side of the tree, so if we can't do anything about this, this is probably when we're looking more at those hypothetical worries. So there isn't actually anything I can do about this, it's outside of my control. And by definition, really, all we can do with those worries is to let them go, which is much easier said than done a lot of the time. But some practical techniques we have to help with that process. And the first one is something called worry time. So the idea of this really is focusing particularly on those hypothetical worries. So when we can't do anything about a worry. So the idea is reducing the amount of time we're spending worrying, really. In a nutshell, worry time is setting aside a time each day where you can worry as much as you like, which sounds a bit counterproductive. But the idea is that actually by having that limited time set aside each day, it means throughout the day we can reduce that worrying, so we can really reduce that time. So we normally recommend as a first step is obviously setting a time in the evening, preferably when you're not going to be too disturbed and not too close to bedtime, because if you've had any experience with worries, they tend to be a lot worse then because there's not much else to do apart from think. So setting a time aside, between 15 to 30 minutes, probably no more than that really. So that's your worry time for the day. And what that means then is throughout the day, any worries that come up, we can capture them. So we can note them down either on paper and pen or on your phone, but just making sure we're putting them down and saying to ourselves, okay, yes, I am worried about this, but actually I'm going to worry about that later during worry time. So it's helping us to get a little bit of control back over that worry. So we're choosing when we're going to allow ourselves to worry. And then it's really important, once you've noted it down, to try and refocus on the present moment. And the reason why we suggest this is because with worries, because it quite often kind of launches us into the future, if we can be really present with what's happening around us, we can't really be thinking about much else, about the future or the past. So refocusing, quite a helpful way is using something like the five senses. So just really tuning in to what we can see, hear, taste, smell, if it's relevant. So even if you're watching TV when the worry popped up, just really trying to engage back in with that. You could be turning up the volume, changing the channel. You might want to do something completely different to try and help with that. But just trying to make us sure we're refocusing. And then it eventually comes to worry time in the evening. So that is your time where you can allow yourself to worry. You can go back over the worries from throughout the day, whether that's on paper or on your phone. And that's your chance to reflect. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second as well. And then at the end of worry time, again, really important to refocus on the present, because you've just given yourself all this time to worry. So we don't want that to keep going long into the evening. So really trying to refocus again after that. So with actually during the worry time, as I mentioned, all we can really do with these hypothetical worries is to let them go. And it is quite difficult sometimes to do that. But there's just some helpful questions we can ask ourselves. So when we're sat in worry time, going through them, some people find it helpful to actually cross them out as well once they've done with each one, or delete them on your phone. But just thinking, okay, well, did this thing happen? And actually, even if it did, how did I cope with it? Would it have actually helped if I'd worried about this all day? Would that have really made a difference? And how important is this really? Is it going to matter in 5 years' time, a week's time? Do I really have any control over whether this will happen? So just having a chance to reflect and go through those worries then. And when it comes to ending worry time, so a couple of things we can do. Some people like to schedule something in afterwards, which they know is going to help them to refocus. So quite a common one is scheduling your worry time just before you'd normally cook dinner. That's a good one for using all the five senses. But anything really that you know is going to absorb you and help you to stay focused. We can hand the worries over to God in prayer at the end. So there's quite a few biblical figures who arguably face quite challenging times in their lives and probably were quite stressed. And Richard actually pointed out a good example from 2 Kings with Hezekiah's prayer. So he'd received a letter from the Assyrians threatening to attack him and his people, at which point Hezekiah went to the house of the Lord at the time, and he took the letter with him and actually laid it out before the Lord and prayed. So I thought it was quite an interesting parallel actually between us writing our worries down and actually handing that over. So we can end our worry time with prayer, hand the worries over at that point as well. Also, meditation can be a really good way of ending that worry time. So things like the Headspace app. Also a Christian meditation app called Abide, which I don't know if people have come across, but it's meditation, but also includes some prayers, some Bible readings with some kind of nice ambient sounds in the background. So quite a helpful one to use as well. But anything really that's going to help you to refocus. At the end of worry time, some people like to physically screw up the piece of paper and throw it away, or delete everything on, not everything on their phone, but all the worries. And I actually once had one person tell me they set fire to their worry list, which I wouldn't recommend. They did say it was very cathartic though. So that's one thing we can do as well. And it's really important that at the end of that, we are getting rid of it in some way. We don't want to be carrying those worries over to the next time, so we're done with them at that point. And really important to remember that if the worries do come back initially, which they probably will, worries have a habit of kind of bouncing back, just still applying that same process. So even if you've had that worry time and they're still coming back, again, starting to note them down, but thinking, okay, yes, I'm worried about this, but actually this is going to be for tomorrow's worry time. So we're still always delaying that. And the reason why is it kind of gives our brain a chance to learn, really, because whenever there's anything we're faced with, any worrying situation, our brain wants us to deal with it and address it there and then. But with hypothetical worries, we can't do that. And our brain isn't that good at distinguishing between real current problems or threats and things that are more imagined, so like these what-if questions. So by doing this, putting in the kind of time and practice, over time, our brain kind of gets the message, actually, that we don't need to be worrying about these things. We don't need to be thinking about them. So that process of delaying is really important for our brain to learn that. And people find the more they practice this, actually, the less frequent the worries become and the less intense they become over time as well. So that is kind of that whistle-stop tour of the worry management with worry time. Any questions or any comments on that at all?
You mentioned obviously handing the worries over to God in prayer and mm-hmm. things like that, but also I think sharing your worries with someone else that yeah. you trust.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they say a problem shares a problem harm.
Yeah.
And also quite often if you talk to someone else, you quite often find that they have similar experiences, they worry about the same sort of
yeah.
things. You don't feel such an absolute twit.
Yeah.
Sometimes you feel, well, why am I feeling anxious about this? But if someone else says, well, actually, I've had that happen, and that helps a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good point, actually, sharing that worry, definitely. No, absolutely. Yeah. Any other kind of questions or comments?
I think that kind of articulation can help you see that it is hypothetical too. You think it's real, but when you talk to someone, they say, that's not really going to happen, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that talking it out really helps.
Yeah, absolutely, giving you that different perspective on it that we wouldn't see ourselves. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Okay, great. Well, just to end, really, there's a couple of helpful resources that me and Steve kind of put together. So we already mentioned one, which was the Headspace app, which has those guided meditations and some videos on there, like the one we watched earlier. Also have the SAM app, which Steve mentioned, which I believe is kind of quite a helpful tool around, I suppose, kind of monitoring, being more aware of our anxiety and some kind of practical things
in
there as
well. And it's got tools that can work for you, that you can note down. It gives you the ability to record when you feel stressed, how you're actually feeling, and you can then see that plotted out on a graph to know when you were. So you can try and link it with things that might have happened during the day. So it is quite good from that perspective.
Yeah. Okay, brilliant. And there's also something called Reach Out Worry Time, which is an app, which is actually made specifically for this worry management technique. So it gives you space to note down the worries throughout the day and remind you of your worry times when you put it in, and only allows you to go through it at worry time. So it's quite restricted, which is good, I think, and then deletes them for you at the end. So just kind of helpful to guide that technique, really. There's also a website or an organisation called the CCI, which is the Centre for Clinical Interventions, and they have tons of information around self-help, around anxiety, depression, and also some problems that aren't necessarily discussed that much, things like assertiveness, perfectionism, procrastination, so lots of helpful tips and tricks there as well, and some guided self-help booklets. So I brought a couple along today on the table. There are some for general stress management, some for worry management, which we've talked about a bit today, and a bit more about the relaxation techniques. If anyone would like to take them, you're very welcome to. But otherwise, thank you very much for coming. Thanks, everyone.
I just thought I'd give the opportunity. Does anyone want to ask any questions about what I had talked about or any other general questions, just to make sure you've got the opportunity? That's fine.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.